This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
And welcome to the Ladies Who London podcast. This is Alex.
And I'm Fiona.
Well, sort of Fiona. Fiona doesn't have much of a voice this week, I'm afraid, gang.
No.
She's rasping away. Such as the perils of high season guiding. You've used it all up.
Yeah, it's all gone. It's just gone.
I think you sound deliciously sexy, so I wouldn't worry too much about it. Well, welcome to the podcast this week, everyone. Thank you for coming along. I have to say, I've got my doors open today because it is hotter than Satan's trousers in here, and there's not a chance I'm going to sit with the doors closed. So if you, and I seem to have some of the loudest birds known to humanity in my garden, although they've all just gone, which is quite handy. So if you do hear lots of tweeting and things going on out there, very sorry, but it's incredibly hot, so
I've shut my windows, but then if there was any background noise you wouldn't hear me at all, so
yeah, that's true. So you might expire during well, just our intro, because we've recorded the main part separately, but I will be cool but have bird song, which is quite nice, I suppose. Yeah. Fiona's just nodding at me. That's all she can do. Well, I won't ask you too much then, Fiona, this week, just because I don't want to. I want you to keep your voice, what remains of it, for your guests. But this week we have a guest along for our podcast. And because Fiona had no voice at all, it's just me interviewing our guest. But we'll get to that very shortly. Parish notices this week. There are a couple of little things it's worth letting you know about. One comes from one of our listeners and a good friend of mine, Stacey McDougall, who has a vested interest in this particular thing. So a few weeks ago, we chatted to Katie Wignall all about the Endell Street Hospital, in particular talking about one of the women who created it and was instrumental in its success and its running, Dr. Flora Murray. Now, Stacey, because she's Scottish, obviously is across all of this, sent me a lovely link to an article that said that there is a £100 note in Scotland, which we don't have in England at all. We only go as far as 50, we're cheap. But in Scotland, a £100 note which Flora Murray is on, and it has just been voted the third most beautiful banknote in the world, which I think is pretty impressive. If you're curious about one and two, number one is a 1,000 peso note by of the Philippines, and the second one, a £50 Ulster banknote. But in third place is the glorious Flora Murray, and it is a beautiful, beautiful note, actually, which is a weird thing to say about a note, I suppose, but it's lovely. She's got pictures of her on there, both a portrait and also pictures of them taking patients out of one of the ambulances and into the hospital. It's really rather lovely. So thanks, Stacey, for letting me know that. I always like it when these things crop back up. And then, secondly, Fiona's... we've just lost Fiona completely. She's just trying to keep her voice. What was the other thing I wanted to say, Fiona? I can't remember now.
Concert.
Oh, yes, yes. So this week we're going to have a second, like a little sort of added extra podcast that's going to come out probably on Sunday. So keep an eye on your podcast boxes, maybe Saturday, which is a little slightly an extension to one of our previous episodes, which is all about the Match Girls and the Match Girls strike. Now, this week I had a chat to a lovely lady called Sam, who is actually related to one of the Match Girls. So a lady called Sarah Chapman. And so we had her on to talk all about it. And interestingly, she is the head of the board of the Match Girls 1888 Foundation. And they have something coming up which we think would be great for a little podcast outing. We've not done one for a while. On the 1st of July now, admittedly, it's only a couple of weeks away. So if you're not in London or haven't got plans to come, it might be out of the realms of possibility. But if you have, we would love to see you. On the 1st of July at 7 p.m. in Bow, there is a new piece of music that's been written. And it's called, it's gone under the project name of Striking Sparks. And basically a new piece of music, which will be performed by both choirs and musicians that are local to the area, is going to be performed in Bow, in a place called the Great Hall of the People's Palace, which I have to say I don't know about, but I feel like I need to know a bit more about that. And it's only £7 or £5 for the concessions, and Fiona and I are going to go, and we thought we'd invite you to come along and join us. I'll probably be masked up, and hopefully Fiona will have her voice back by then. But if you'd like to come and join us, please do. It says you can buy tickets in advance or get them on the door. I think we're going to pre-buy just to make sure that we're in there. But let's make it another outing. If you're around, I realise it's quite short notice, but if you're around and you fancy it, on the 1st of July, please do come and join us. But there'll be some more information in the podcast, this sort of extra little additional one that will come out this week. And we'll put it on our socials too. So if you do want to join us, then you can come along also, and do so. Also,
you could just come and you don't have to talk to us.
Yes, you don't have to talk to us.
You could just stay anonymous and just like listen to the music and go home.
We'll take it personally, but which actually, when we did Operation Mincemeat, I think somebody did that. Somebody was like, "Oh, I'm too embarrassed to come and say hi." But we had a good crowd for that. So yeah, please, you don't feel you have to talk to us. We're
good impressive. Little hold that thought,
yes,
listeners, until next week when I can explain more. But we're going to call back to Operation Mincemeat as well.
Okay. Exciting. Right, well, this week, let's crack on with the podcast. And today we are discussing somebody who is a really interesting character and not one that I knew anything about, a lady called Evelyn De Morgan. And Evelyn De Morgan was, I'll explain a lot more in the podcast, but she's a very interesting person, and there is an exhibition on all about her in London at the moment. So we will catch you on the flip side. This week, listeners, we have a fantastic guest. I'm really thrilled to introduce you to Sarah Hardy, who is the director of the De Morgan Museum, because we're going to be chatting about a really fascinating woman. So welcome, Sarah, to the Ladies in London podcast.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Now, we've got you on because, as our listeners know, we tend to talk about the people who are less known about in British history. And we do a lot of women as well. And this lady, Evelyn De Morgan, has come up slightly almost by chance for me, because she's currently got an exhibition. We've got an exhibition of her work. She's sadly not around anymore, at the fabulous Leighton House in West London. Now, we've promised our listeners an episode on Leighton House, which we will do as well, because Frederick Lord Leighton is a fascinating character. But Leighton House are working with you at the moment on an exhibition of a selection of the works of Evelyn De Morgan, who was a fabulous Pre-Raphaelite painter, and her work is stunning. So we thought we'd get you on to have a little chat about her, because the more I was reading up about her, the more fascinating she was. And we thought, well, actually, this is a fantastic topic. So as director of the De Morgan Museum, you are, I guess, the expert on Evelyn De Morgan, right?
Yeah, that was quite a scary moment, actually, when I took on the full-time role in 2018, and then suddenly overnight, you're the expert in in an artist. But 5 years on, I would safely say that, yeah, having sort of devoted the last 5 years to the study of the work of her and her husband, William De Morgan, who is an amazing ceramicist as well, so he'll probably come up whilst we're chatting today. And, you know, by nature of him being a male artist, I think that's possibly a name that your listeners might have heard of before, a little bit more than his wife, which is what we're here to set the record straight.
Absolutely. And she is, so she does come under the Pre-Raphaelite banner, which is quite a famous art movement. And it's got quite a particular look to it, hasn't it? You can, it's a really easy movement to pick out. You can look at something and go, oh, that's Pre-Raphaelite, because they definitely have a style, don't they?
Yeah, that was the whole aim of the Brotherhood, really, when it was established in 1848, is they wanted to break away from the tradition of what had been done before and sort of have quite a radical, fresh, new look at the world around them and to portray that through their artworks. And I mean, the key crucial elements of that were to create, excuse me, artworks which were had a truth to nature, is how they described it. So they would go outside and paint very detailed elements of nature and embed that into their paintings. But they also wanted work to be relevant and address modern subjects, but did that by looking at the work of Raphael and the artists who'd come before him. So there's a real historical element to the artworks as well. So how that manifests is you often get these sort of lovely languishing maids in yeah. these beautiful, very realistic, almost hyper-realistic depictions, often of real people. They use real models from the modern world around them. Their methods were interesting as well. So they would always use a very white ground to paint their colours on. So you get very kind of bright, jewel-like paintings, which, sometimes it's hard to believe they're up to 150 years old.
They are wonderful. And again, it was that thing of going against what was expected of the art world at the time, wasn't it? Which is often where you get these fantastic movements from. I mean, we look at possibly the most famous art movement of all, which is the Impressionists, is exactly what they were doing. And the sort of the established, I guess, art at the time was, it was actually quite classical, wasn't it? It was quite, looking at the Renaissance and really harking back to that. And I love a groundbreaker. I love somebody who goes, you know what you're doing? I'm going to do the complete opposite. And that's what the Pre-Raphaelites did.
Yeah, so it's interesting with De Morgan, with when we've got that in mind about these groundbreaking people, because she definitely, absolutely fits into that mold. She was actually born in 1855, which was 3 years after the Brotherhood had all but disbanded, really. So she was growing up with the legacy of Pre-Raphaelite art and what it had done for art education and for public displays of art in Britain in particular. But she was definitely a groundbreaker. Her parents were from upper middle class. Her father was a QC and her mother was from the landed gentry. And apparently her mother is quoted as saying that she wanted a daughter, not an artist. And this gives us an idea of the gender stereotypes around her at the time. And she really did have to sort of stake her claim in the game as a woman. Mm. Now, fortuitously for her, the Slade School of Art had opened at the right time that she was the right age to enter. And she became one of the first female students to go there. And the real benefit of this is that the Slade allowed women into the life drawing room. So something that had always been very much established as a critical element to art education, to be able to draw from the life model. And that's a real person, often nude. So you can imagine the taboos in Victorian Britain around allowing young women to access particularly nude male models. But the Slade allowed that. And so De Morgan sort of went there and really honed her craft in life drawing particularly quickly, went on to win a full scholarship at the Slade. So 3 years of funding towards her studies and access to other schools at University College London, or University of London as it was then. So we know that she attended anatomy classes and saw live dissections of human models and took notes from that. So again, just really for a young woman to be doing that at the time, it was quite groundbreaking, really.
That's incredible. And just very quickly coming back to her mum, I did read somewhere, and you can correct me if this is completely wrong, but didn't her mother tell her art tutor to tell her that she was actually quite rubbish at art to stop her becoming an artist?
Apparently so. So all these sort of stories about her come from the biography her sister wrote about her in 1922. Now, her sister was 10 years younger than her, so lots of it must have been hearsay and sort of family jokes and
family lore and that sort of
exactly. So I always take it with a little bit of a pinch of salt, but given her mother's background, like I say, from the landed gentry, very upper middle class, it's highly likely. And we know that from that same source, De Morgan's response to this was that if she had to be presented as a debutante to society, then she would go and kick the queen, apparently. So that shows how she felt about
that
more genteel
hilarious.
Side of London life. Yeah, she wasn't prepared to be presented to society at all. She wanted to go off and do her thing and live this bohemian lifestyle and become an artist, which happily for us today, she managed to do.
And so you say she at the art school, she was allowed to go to the life drawing classes and that sort of thing. Did she have the sort of full range of access to things like that as the male students, or were there any sort of, you know, restrictions on her?
Yeah, so women had to draw from a covered model, i.e. the privates would be
the danglies.
Shrouded from these poor young, you know, gentle women who, you know, couldn't possibly face anything like that. So all of her sketches from her time of the Slade have these men in these quite cumbersome nappies, which is quite amusing. It also states in the Slade prospectus, which is still in the University of London's archive today, from 1872 when she started, that women cannot attend the live room after 5 p.m. Goodness knows what would happen if they saw a nude figure.
Is that after 5 p.m. all bets are off?
The men only in the evening hours. And again, this just goes to show what the taboo of Victorian London was, and how closely associated sort of artist models were with prostitution. You know, they're absolutely synonymous in the public imagination. So to allow young women into that space really was sort of breaking away from tradition in quite a major way. And she was at the epicenter of that. She was right at the beginning of it.
That's so interesting, because again, yeah, like you say, it's that thing of things are starting to change, but only in a little way. And if any woman that steps out of line sort of gets tarred with this brush of, you know, either a disruptor or usually just an easy one, like you say, prostitution, which it's funny because we see that with the story. I'm completely tangenting here of Jack the Ripper in the 1880s, where they say, oh, they were all prostitutes. And actually, there's been a lot of, a particular book written recently by Hallie Rubenhold called The Five talks about how actually, no, they weren't. Maybe one was, but the rest of them weren't. But it's a very easy thing to kind of write off women if they don't fit into whatever it is that you're trying to put forward. That, and also interesting, because Evelyn De Morgan, of course, like you say, she's from a very good background without wanting to sort of, you know, class shame anybody, but there was definitely a sort of class divide there, wasn't there, of women of a certain class were expected to do a certain thing, and so then to be just easily tarred with that brush because she didn't fit in is quite something, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah, it's quite major.
Yeah, so this school, amazingly, the Slade gives her the space to explore and paint, and then you said it gives her access to London, University of London as it was. How does she kind of go from there to then breaking into the art world, which must have been, again, another barrier for a woman to have to do?
Yeah, I mean, I can only put it down to talent, really. It was when she started at the Slade that she stopped using her Christian name, which was actually Mary, and began using her middle name, Evelyn, or Evelyn, however people pronounce it. And I think that's because that was a unisex name. Men were called Evelyn as well. And so that she could really be assessed on her own merit rather than having the, you know, oh, she's a woman, so it's never going to be as good. Yeah. And the number of prizes she won at the Slade is quite astonishing for her compositional work, from her study from life and from the antique model as well. And so as soon as she sort of finished at the Slade, it's a bit woolly as to exactly when, the records don't really cover that. But she started exhibiting her artworks immediately. And in 1876, when she was just 21 years old, she exhibited at the very prestigious Dudley Gallery. And a Guardian journalist actually wrote a piece on her artwork, which was a very similar work to, if anyone knows it, Raphael's St. Catherine. You can definitely see that there's stylistic influences from Raphael there. And it was her St. Catherine of Alexandria that the Guardian artist said, it's a beautiful piece of art, and you'll be so surprised to know it's by a woman artist by the name of Miss Pickering, as she was then. So, yeah, even, you know, the shock that a woman could produce something that was good, is probably something that helped propel her. And when the first Grosvenor Gallery exhibition opened, which is a fabulous exhibition space, sort of a rival to the Royal Academy Summer Exhibition, which I know, again, lots of your listeners will know about.
Yep.
and it was established in the 1870s by Sir Coutts Lindsay of Bank fame to really celebrate modern artists and people working in what was known by then as the aesthetic movement tradition. So she was invited to exhibit alongside some of the greats of the day, such as Frederick Law Leighton, who we've mentioned, G.F. Watts, Burne Jones. So she was handpicked from that initial exhibition success that she'd had, and her early paintings were bought by the great and the good of London society, various different MPs and lords. So yeah, she was sort of well renowned pretty quickly into her professional career.
That's so fantastic. So why is it then that we don't know her name quite as much as we do a lot of other contemporaries?
Yeah, it's horrendous, isn't it? I don't know. I wish I knew. And, you know, as a woman myself, speaking on the Ladies Who London podcast, I think we all know the why, because she's a woman. It's really the only thing you can put it down to. When you look at her paintings and her artworks today alongside those of some of her contemporaries, you know, they are as good, if not better, in some cases, as the artworks she was looking at and being inspired by in her circle. So it's a sorry story, isn't it, of history sort of male washing what it means to be successful.
Yeah, we see this, we do see this quite a lot with a lot of the topics that we cover, so it comes as no surprise really for that to be a factor. So talk me through a little bit. So actually, for our listeners, we will have our show notes, we'll put the pictures up there so you can see, and what we'll do is we'll put the Raphael side by side with Evelyn, so you can kind of see the two, because they do, yeah, it's really lovely. You can see the influence very much there, which is really lovely. So talk to me a little bit about her style. So we said pre-Raphaelite, and she has got this gorgeous, I mean, like you say, pre-Raphaelites are all about breaking the mold a bit, and it's very much about people, and she's done this study on figures, but she takes it one step further, and actually this exhibition at Leighton House is known as the gold paintings, which I mean is quite exciting. So what is it? Tell me a bit more about that.
Yeah, I'll just come at this from a completely personal perspective, because it's sort of my journey into how this exhibition came about, really. So when I took over at the De Morgan Foundation, obviously I'd known the paintings, they were up on the walls and you're able to see them. But starting as director at the museum, I then instantly had access to the De Morgan Foundation's archives, which include 800 of these works on paper, which the gold drawings or paintings are. And I found one of them and I just thought, what on earth is this? You know, I'd sort of never seen it in person before, only on a screen, and you just, you know, it doesn't do them justice. And I started to try and kind of rack my brains for other things from the period that were similar. And I knew that Burne Jones had produced gold drawings on a sort of an indigo paper of his own invention. He'd been very inspired by medieval illuminated manuscripts to experiment in gold. But some of her compositions just really take that quite a lot further, and they're very elaborate, very detailed, and have this amazing range of textures in them, all produced in monochrome gold on a dark paper. And even now, to this day, after having the exhibition open, when sometimes you get feedback from different art historians, we're yet to identify another artist from the period outside of De Morgan and Burne Jones who were working in this media. It's really incredible that, you know, she may have seen one of Burne Jones's. We know through friends and family links that she knew him, that she'd spent time with him, that she would have visited his exhibitions. But yeah, for her to sort of take that idea and run with it, if it, you know, I hate crediting it to Burne Jones, who was never particularly nice about her. So she may have sort of thought of it on her own, and they, you know, somehow produced these things simultaneously. But she really did push the possibilities of it through her technical mastery of the craft. And like I said, the compositions that she creates are far more ambitious than any by Burne Jones in this medium. So they really are fantastic. And I just thought, you know, we've got to get these out on show. So I undertook quite a lot of research into them, and was particularly interested in how she'd made them, because, you know, if it was such an easy to come by material, why wasn't everybody doing it? They look fantastic. And so what we found was an archive of the sales ledgers of a colourman who was an art supplier in the Victorian period called Charles Robeson. And happily for us, De Morgan had an account with him. And also happily for us, he was a very meticulous record keeper.
So we like them.
Yeah, we really love them. They are excellent. And in stark contrast to the De Morgans themselves, who weren't very good record keepers, frustratingly. So there's this whole sort of section in the ledger titled Evelyn De Morgan, or Evelyn Pickering, as she was before she married, with her address and everything she was buying from him. And what it appears that she did from looking at these records was work very closely with Robeson to have canvases prepared to her exact specifications. She'd take them back in and get him to cut them down to size for her.
Okay.
And something that I noticed she was buying was a cake of gold. Oh, yummy. No,
now, is this actual gold, is it?
So what a cake is a dry pellet of pigment. So if you think of your watercolour boxes you had in primary school, mm-hmm. that's what a cake is. You add the water and it becomes wet. But with it being gold, there must be something else in there. And whether that is pure gold or whether it's a chemical creation, chemistry is not fantastic, as you can tell, sort of something that's been put together synthetically to make the appearance of gold when it is added to paper. But because she's painting on paper and not canvas, and the gold is so bright, you know this, Alex, you've seen them, it sort of twinkles from the wall. I believe she was doing something a little bit different with this pigment. And I think what she probably would have had to do is grind it into a very fine powder, a very dusty powder, and add something a little bit harder than water that would have stuck it together. So perhaps an oil, but probably something like a gum arabic to make her own quite thick paints in order to achieve this range of textures that she does throughout the drawing. So you can see already, you know, even though, you know, why is her reputation not better known? I wish it was, as well as having the insight to produce the beautiful paintings that sort of fit in with the stereotypical movements and looks of the day. She was also very interested in the technical aspects of her artwork and really did push her craft to the extreme and created these fantastic and beautiful things by doing so.
And it's such a unique, like you say, no one else was doing it. Burne Jones was doing it a bit, but not this way. And so it's so unique. And that's what I think really makes her stand out amongst the other Pre-Raphaelites as well. So do you think she has a particular masterpiece? Do you think there's one piece that sums her up or that is just her absolute, you know, the zenith of her talent? What would you...
Is that in total or from within the gold drawings?
Well, I think in total, but let's do both. Actually, let's do the best of the gold drawings, and then her masterpiece elsewhere.
So I will just caveat this by saying it's so hard to do because the range of pictures that she was creating really did fit into a number of movements. So in sort of quite stark contrast to lots of the leading men of the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood, she lived until 1919. So her career actually expanded through a number of different art movements. We've got works that look symbolist, which is a movement that sort of came over from France in the late 19th century. Got paintings that fit in very clearly with the aesthetic movement narrative. So the group championed by Oscar Wilde that believed in art for art's sake, or that art should be beautiful, with no narrative kind of above everything else. Then she hits the kind of later Pre-Raphaelite wave where we've got these very richly detailed medieval looking paintings. But then around the time of the First World War, she really changed tact and made very deep, meaningful images that are quite arresting and really commented on the great impact on humanity and humankind through the Great War that she lived through. So we've got this kind of amazing spectrum of different styles that she fits into. And then we've got this range of different techniques she uses as well. So from the works on paper through to her fantastic drawings, which are just astonishing and really beautiful.
What you're saying is I posed you an impossible question, right?
Yeah, you have. But I think there is one within her paintings, and it's a picture called Flora from 1894. So really, when she was at the peak of her artistic training, she was spending 6 months of the year living in Italy by this point. And Flora is the goddess of springtime and Florence, the city she lived in and loved. And in terms of its technical kind of mastery of oil painting and how beautiful it is, that's the one really for me. It's a painting that gets requested for loan quite a lot. It's currently in America. And I just don't worry about it as much as I do of some of the other artworks that, so, you know, how conservators look at it. And they said the way she's put the painting together is so intelligent and so clever that it is just standing the test of time beautifully. And it looks as though it was painted yesterday. It's a fabulous picture.
It is absolutely gorgeous. I've not seen it in person. I've only ever seen pictures of it online. I'm just going to describe it for the listeners. And again, they can see this in our show notes, but you've got this beautiful, it's a very long, thin piece, vertical piece, with this beautiful woman standing with flowing, well, sort of reddish blonde hair. And I mean, it literally looks like she's underwater. It's sort of flowing up and all over. And then she's got this gorgeous draped gold gown with covered in flower imagery. And that's the gold section, isn't it? Of the, is that actually the that's the bit she uses the gold paint on, is the dress.
Yeah, so it's got gold in it. So when it's lit correctly in a gallery, it kind of radiates into the space around you. And it's quite a thing to be in front of, you know. It's quite an impactful piece to see in real life, really.
I can't wait to see it in real life. And she's standing barefoot on a carpet of flowers and grass, and then behind her is this beautiful bush with loads of what look like oranges or possibly even pears or clementines on, and then there's a beautiful blue sky behind that. And it's really lovely. It feels very, it's a very romantic image, which I guess Flora is a sort of slightly romantic goddess, isn't she, really? It's all about springtime and, you know, new birth and all this sort of thing. But it is a really, really stunning piece. I wondered if you were going to say Flora, because I think it's gorgeous. But that's not in the exhibition at the moment, is it?
It's not, no. That's an oil painting. And what we wanted to do in this exhibition is absolutely focus on these gold drawings, really, so that we could write the interpretation, so the bits that you read when you go into the exhibition, to focus on her skill and her mastering of this craft. Because so often with women artists, that doesn't get included. You'll get some biography, you'll get to hear about some of the men you've heard of that they knew. Yeah. And we wanted to completely erase all of that. So there's very little kind of biographical information in the exhibition. It really does hone in and focus on this unique medium that she was working in, and on the narrative she wanted to communicate through the subjects that she tackled within them.
Fantastic. And would you say there's one particular piece in the exhibition that you think is the absolute must see, or is it very much the narrative is spread across everything? What would you?
Oh no, I've got a favourite in that one.
Oh, okay, okay.
So that's definitely one of these gold, beautiful gold drawings on dark paper called Gloria in Excelsis. So this is the moment in the Bible stories when the angels are sent from heaven to announce the birth of Christ to the shepherds. So we have these two stunning women in lots of flowing drapery with their enormous wings. One of them's got a harp, and one of them's got a scroll to sing the Gloria to the shepherds. And then there's this huge choir of cherubs above them in this arc, kind of leaning up to heaven. But the way the figures were arranged is so clever that the two angels at the front of us look like they're stepping into your space. Mm. Yeah. And I think for her, being someone who was very, I think we'd probably describe her spiritual today. So she did go to church, you know, she was a Christian in faith, but also believed in spiritualism and practiced communicating with the spirits of the departed, as many sort of genteel Victorians did. But I think for her, this picture is almost, you know, the angels are like living, breathing humans, and having them almost stepping forward into our space really is bridging that gap between the sacred and the profane, in only a way that possibly this beautiful illuminating gold pigment taken from medieval altarpieces could possibly do. So that's a real treat to see that one, if you can make it to Leighton House.
And I remember when I saw that one, like you say, it because it obviously the gold looks amazing, and like you say, they look like they're stepping forward. And I remember looking at it all, and then suddenly the angel on the right, you just lock eyes with it and it's looking out at you. And then that was the bit that made me really feel part of the image. I was like, oh my goodness. You know, it was almost like we shared a moment. It was quite bizarre, because often they don't, unless it's a portrait of a aristocrat or something. And even then, they're not always looking out of the image at you. And especially in things like this, they often aren't, when it's more of a allegorical something. But there, this bit where the angel was just sort of looking at you, I was like, oh, okay, I'm part of this now. It was really quite amazing.
Yeah, it's very clever, isn't it? A real way to draw you in by having that human connection through space and time with a drawing from 150 years ago. It's amazing. Yeah.
Absolutely. So you mentioned that she lived in 1919, so she lived through the First World War, and And you said that her art changed a lot. And she does do quite a few pieces where she has an almost physical manifestation of war and suffering in dragons and things like that, doesn't she? And which is, I was quite intrigued by, because like you say, it's the Pre-Raphaelites, we are the core, let's say, trad Pre-Raphaelites are earlier. So they never would have got to that stage. So it's a really interesting, the sort of things she must have lived through. I mean, she lived through, you know, the Industrial Revolution, the aftermath of all of that, the change of a quite, you know, well-known monarch and then the First World War. There's a lot of change that she's seeing in that era. And that must have felt quite, I don't know, disconcerting in a way, especially towards the end of her life. Suddenly you've got this huge war across the continent. And you can imagine that it's going to affect her art.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for artists like her that really poured their heart and soul into their pictures, that's kind of her window on the world. And she was very reactive to things happening around her, but I think she always did it in quite an intelligent way, where she was able to almost stick with what people expected of her aesthetically and then use that to subvert the messaging going on around her and kind of always fill her pictures with her social and political beliefs. You know, she was very engaged and very switched on in not just the art world but the wider world around her. And I mean, yeah, we definitely see that with her series of quite profound war pictures. But, you know, earlier than that, it's the feminism always comes through in her pictures. So as early as 1889, she signed the Declaration in Favour of Women's Suffrage and continued to sort of, not very publicly, but always through her art, kind of supported women's rights. When you look at a series of her paintings, if you go online and do that, you'll notice that often the main character, the protagonist, is always the woman, even when she's depicting kind of the Trojan War. She focuses on Cassandra from mythology, so the prophetess who could hear the future, but no one believed her when she spoke it. And I think obviously using that character from history, it's quite telling, isn't it, of what she thought was going on in the world around her. And you know, I promised you a bit of William de Morgan as well, and it's always a good time to bring him up because they married in 1887. They had a very unusually equal marriage for the day, in that Evelyn was the main breadwinner. She bought the house that they lived in as a married couple in her name, in her maiden name, before the wedding. But he was a very public advocate for women's suffrage and used his position of fame that he found in his later years as an author to advocate for and become what we call today, you know, a really strong ally for equality, for women's rights. So he became the vice president of the Men's League for Women's Suffrage in 1914. And there's lots of letters, in open letters in newspapers by him, sort of really showing his support.
That's fantastic. And it is really edifying, isn't it, when you get a strong woman who is fighting for things like that, and the husband is very much aligned with those values. And we do see it a lot, especially in the Victorian era, of women who do that. And they, you know, it says, oh, their husband was also aligned with that. Because that's what you want, isn't it? You don't want them to be marrying just for the sake of marrying and settling down with somebody who doesn't support that, when you've got someone who's a very strong woman and a very strong advocate for that. So that's fantastic. That's really good to know.
Yeah, instead of being completely demasculated by her success, he was absolutely, I think they were behind each other. You know, it just always feels, whenever I read anything about them, like a really, you know, proper loving relationship. It's very heartwarming, really.
That's so lovely.
I know, I think they were sweethearts.
Oh, I rather like that. And so you said they got married in 1887, yeah. Was it? So that's actually quite late for her to marry in Victorian standards. She'd been 32, wouldn't she? So
yeah, and he was 46. So it's quite a big age gap between them as well. And I think maybe that's what helped. You know, they both had their success in their own right, and then come together as these two kind of great artistic figures through friendship groups they were both in. And
you would hope that people who break the boundaries with their career and their work are also going to break the boundaries with their life as well. They're just their social everything. So I love that. They're like, yeah, we're just going to do what we want stuff the haters, which is fantastic. We're going to take a very quick pause now.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda. Whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch, find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Okay, back to the podcast. And so they said they had a very happy marriage. Did Evelyn outlive her husband, or the other way around? Or
she did, but only by 2 years.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, lots of people say maybe she died of a broken heart, which is quite sweet. But yeah, she was quite young when she died. I can't remember that. I think she had a chronic illness, something to do with her heart, maybe. But yeah, she only outlived him by 2 years. William died in 1917, and she followed in 1919.
And they're buried in, well, Brookwood Cemetery, aren't they? So yeah, globally London.
Lovely London, but out in Woking, if anyone fancies stomping around, quite an interesting graveyard. I've been to visit their grave myself, and it's beautiful. It was designed by Evelyn and carved by George Frampton, very celebrated arts and crafts carver. And it's worth going to see if you're into that sort of thing.
Absolutely. Well, we have done a podcast before on the necro train, the death train that took people from Waterloo. So it's amazing how these things
have been on that.
They probably would have been, wouldn't they? I suppose. Yeah, my goodness. It's amazing how these things come together. So you're the director of the De Morgan Museum, and there's the foundation that goes with it as well. So where is the museum? What else does the foundation do? What do you do apart from this fantastic exhibition at Leighton House? What else? How does it work?
Yeah, it's a million-dollar question, and people often ask me, where are you based? And I think, right, here we go. And then you can see them sort of slowly getting bored. But I'll do my best by giving you a bit of a history of the foundation to support what we do today. So the entire De Morgan collection, which is about 2,500 artworks with all the drawings and ceramics by William De Morgan, as well as the paintings by Evelyn, and that was collected by Evelyn's younger sister, who I mentioned before, who wrote the biography in 1922. So she was 10 years younger than Evelyn and lived to be 99. So she didn't actually die until 1965. And she collected all of this artwork and had it in her home with her up until her death. And the story goes, you could go knock on her door at Old Battersea House, just south of the Thames near Battersea Park. And either her or the butler would let you in and sort of give you a candlelight tour of this kind of quite Mish Haversham-esque sounding building. And then after she died, she'd set up a trust to look after the collection. So that is what is now today the De Morgan Foundation, the charity that owns all the artwork. But very sadly, the house was on a lease from Battersea Council, so we never inherited any property. So since the time that she passed away, the charity owns the art collection. So we work in partnership with lots of lovely other organisations who help us to display this fantastic collection. And the main site for that is now known as the De Morgan Museum, after we received our accreditation status in November 2022, so just last
year. Congratulations.
Thank you. That was a huge undertaking, but we wanted to have that that specific site because we do so much exhibition work, it felt good to have a home. And the reason it's at Cannon Hall in Barnsley is that that was Evelyn De Morgan's mother's family home. So Evelyn spent a lot of time there in the 1880s, so it felt like a really lovely historic link to have the De Morgan Museum at Cannon Hall. So our home is at Evelyn's home, if that makes sense. Yeah. But we also have partnership exhibitions at the Watts Gallery in Surrey, which people might know, at the fantastic Whittick Manor in Wolverhampton, which is a beautiful Arts and Crafts National Trust property. Mm-hmm. We have a display of ceramics at the Ashmolean. There's a small display of one painting and some ceramics at the Queen's House in Greenwich. And then we have our touring exhibition. So currently the Gold Drawings exhibition at Leighton House. And we have an exhibition of ceramics called Sublime Symmetry, but it looks at William's interest in mathematics through his ceramic designs, which is at RAM, the Royal Albert Memorial Museum in Exeter, until September this year. So one or two things going on.
Blimey, goodness me.
I forgot anybody.
That's a busy old workload for you and all of the other paintings. That's amazing. Goodness, what a success.
I actually think it's a lovely operating model. You know, it gives as many people as we possibly could the opportunity to see these artworks and really try and get the De Morgan name better known. That's
fantastic. We do have listeners all over the place. So if they want to find out if there's something close to them, is there a website that they can go to have a look?
Yeah, you can go to our website, which is very easy. It's demorgan, all one word, .org.uk.
Fab. And then it'll have a list of what's where and amazing. And so the exhibition at Leighton House, now this is, we have a bit of an exclusive here, don't we? because it was due to be finishing in August. However, it's just been extended. And yeah, I think we are
by popular demand.
By popular demand. I think we're the first to announce that. I think it's also going to they're going to announce it on the same day as this podcast goes live. So when is it now extended until?
I should have checked that. Shouldn't I? Definitely October.
Definitely October. Sometime in October.
In October. I want to say the 1st, but then if it's the 31st, that's terrible, isn't it?
October.
Check our website. I'll make sure it's updated. But yeah, it means you've got through right till the end of the summer, at least, to
Fantastic.
See it. And I'm actually looking forward to seeing it, you know, when the nights start drawing in again and the heat's gone. And we'll, you know, I think they really lend themselves to an autumn winter show. Better than a summer one. But
absolutely. Just glitter. Oh, they're incredible. Absolutely wonderful. So if people want to go and see the exhibition, then it's at Leighton House, which is in West London. It's £11 entry for an adult or £9 for a concession. And the exhibition is free once you're in there. So it's all part of it. But Leighton House itself is, I mean, one of my favourite little places in London. It's such a unique spot, to the point where the first time I went, I fell in love with the tiles in the main hall. And I had to get tiles as close as I could to that for my bathroom.
You must.
It is interior design goals. It really is. And I think the gold paintings just totally tie in with that, because the Leighton House is just all about opulence and beauty and over the topness, and it's just wonderful. So listeners, you have until October to go and catch this, which is fantastic.
And I will just pop in, Alex, and say that actually with the new redeveloped Leighton House, actually you don't have to pay for the gold drawings exhibition. You can get into that for free, but I mean, definitely go and see the rest of the museum whilst you're there.
You can go for free without going into the rest of the house.
Interesting.
Interesting.
Okay. So well worth going. Just save you all £11. There you go.
But we want you to go to Leighton House as well, obviously.
Yes,
if you've not been. Oh, that's so amazing. Thank you so much for coming and chatting to me, Sarah. It's been a real treat finding out about Evelyn De Morgan. And I have to say, I'm having done a little bit of reading and chatting to you today, I'm obsessed. I think she's amazing. And I'm going to be going back to have another look at the exhibition, which is it's brilliant. So please do, listeners, if you're in London. We do have a few people who do live in London and go to pretty much everything, which is fantastic. They know who they are.
I don't know if you've been.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll tag your social media in our post as well, so that people can follow you. And yeah, if you know, do go and let Sarah know if you've been to have a little look, because it is really, really worth it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Sarah. Really appreciate you popping along.
Thank you. Good to talk to you. Bye.
So there we go, team. That was Evelyn De Morgan, and a massive thank you to Sarah for coming along and chatting to us about a really fascinating lady who, again, like so many women who break boundaries who we've not spoken about or not heard about. I absolutely love it. Have you been to see the exhibition yet, Fiona?
Not yet. No, I've been to Leighton House since it reopened, but not to this exhibition. And I don't know, did this come up in your chat? I noticed they've been shortlisted. Leighton House has been shortlisted for Museum of the Year from
Didn't come up.
The Arts Fund, I think. So,
fantastic!
Fingers crossed for them for that.
Amazing. And we are going to be having a chat with somebody from Leighton House about the museum and Frederick Lord Leighton at some point in the not too distant future as well, because it is Frederick Lord Leighton is unbelievably brilliant. And in fact, we should definitely do that before later on this year, because Pygmalion is coming to the Old Vic, and there is a link between Frederick Lord Leighton and Pygmalion, George Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion. So maybe we should do that before Pygmalion. I'm not going to tell you what it is, because, you know, otherwise we ruin a future podcast. But that might be quite a nice one to slot in. So we'll see if we can get that before Pygmalion comes onto the stage. Which I've just booked tickets for today, actually. All very exciting. Evelyn De Morgan, if you can go and catch the exhibition as they announced in our podcast, we have a first. It is being extended till October. So please do go and have a look. But this week, that's everything from us, I think.
What?
Anything to add, Fiona, before we say goodbye?
Not really.
No.
It'll keep till next week.
Fabulous. Well, listen, gang, we will see you next week, and also this weekend when we give you a little bit of something extra as well for your listening pleasure. Have a wonderful week. We'll see you then. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.